Send Me to Sleep is a production of Slumber Studios and is made possible thanks to the generous support of our sponsors and premium members. If you'd like to listen ad-free and have access to special bonus episodes, you can try out Premium Free for 7 days by following the link in the episode notes. Now, we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with security shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Welcome to Send Me to Sleep, the place to find a good night's rest. My name's Andrew. Thanks for joining me, and for taking this time for yourself to ensure you get a peaceful night's sleep. Tonight, I'll be reading North and South by Elizabeth Gaskell. Chapter 19. In the last chapter, Mr. and Mrs. Thornton discussed their upcoming dinner party and the troubles of the strikes at the mill. In this chapter, Margaret visits Bessie Higgins and talks with her about the upcoming party. If you haven't already, find a nice place to get cozy. Take a deep, relaxing breath. And settle your body in whatever way feels most comfortable. Now all you'll need to do is follow the sound of my voice. So let your eyes fall heavy. And your breath soften. As we settle in for a peaceful night's sleep. Chapter 19. Angel visits. As angels in some brighter dream call to the soul when man doth sleep, so some strange thoughts transcend our wonted themes and into glory peep. Henry Vaughan. Mrs. Hale was curiously amused and interested by the idea of the Thornton dinner party. She kept wondering about the details with something of the simplicity of a little child who wants to have all its anticipated pleasure described beforehand. But the monotonous life led by the seriously ill often makes them like children, inasmuch as they have neither of them any sense of proportion in events, and seem each to believe that the walls and curtains which shut their world and shut out everything else must of necessity be larger than anything hidden beyond. Besides, Mrs. Hale had had her vanities as a girl, had perhaps unduly felt their mortification when she became a poor clergyman's wife. they had been smothered and kept down. But they were not extinct, and she liked to think of seeing Margaret dressed up for a party, and discussed what she should wear with an unsettled anxiety that amused Margaret, who had been more accustomed to society in her 1 year in Harley Street than her mother in 25 years of Helston. Then you think you shall wear your white silk. Are you sure it will fit? It's nearly a year since Edith was married. Oh, yes, Mama. Mrs. Murray made it, and it's sure to be right. It may be a straw's breadth shorter or longer waisted, according to my having grown fat or thin. But I don't think I've altered in the least. Hadn't you better let Dixon see it? It may have gone yellow with lying by. If you like, Mama. But if the worst comes to the worst, I've a very nice pink gauze which Aunt Shaw gave me, only 2 or 3 months before Edith was married. That can't have gone yellow. No, but it may have faded. Well, then I've a green silk. I feel more as if it was the embarrassment of riches. I wish I knew what you ought to wear, said Mrs. Hale nervously. Margaret's manner changed instantly. Shall I go and put them on, one after another, Mama? And then you could see which you liked best. But, yes, perhaps that will be best. So off Margaret went. She was very much inclined to play some pranks when she was dressed up at such an unusual hour, to make her rich white silk balloon out into a cheese, to retreat backwards from her mother as if she were the queen. But when she found that these freaks of hers were regarded as interruptions to the serious business, and as such annoyed her mother, she became grave and sedate. What had possessed the world, her world, to fidget so about her dress? She could not understand. But that very afternoon, on naming her engagement to Bessie Higgins, apropos of the servant that Mrs. Thornton had promised to inquire about, Bessie quite roused up at the intelligence. Dear, and are you going to dine at Thornton's at Marlborough Mills? Yes, Bessie. Why are you so surprised? Oh, I dunno, but they visit with the first folk in Milton. And you don't think we're quite the first folk in Milton, eh, Bessie? Bessie's cheeks flushed a little at her thought being thus easily read. Well, said she, you see, they thinking a deal of money here, and I reckon you've not gotten much. No, said Margaret, that's very true. But we are educated people, and have lived amongst educated people. Is there anything so wonderful in our being asked out to dinner by a man who owns himself inferior to my father, by coming to him to be instructed? I don't mean to blame Mr. Thornton. Few draper's assistants, as he was once, could have made themselves what he is. But can you give dinners back? In your small house, Thornton's house is 3 times as big. Well, I think we could manage to give Mr. Thornton a dinner back, as you call it. Perhaps not in such a large room, nor with so many people. But I don't think we've thought about it at all in that way. I never thought you'd be dining with Thorntons, repeated Bessie. Why, the Mayor Hissell dines there, and the Members of Parliament and all. I think I could support the honour of meeting the Mayor of Milton. But them ladies dress so grand, said Bessie, with an anxious look at Margaret's print gown, which her Milton eyes appraised at 7 pence a yard. Margaret's face dimpled up into a merry laugh. Thank you, Bessie, for thinking so kindly about my looking nice among all the smart people. But I've plenty of grand gowns. A week ago, I should have said they were far too grand for anything I should ever want here. But as I'm to dine at Mr. Thornton's, and perhaps to meet the mayor, I shall put on my very best gown, you may be sure. What will you wear? Asked Bessie, somewhat relieved. White silk, said Margaret. A gown I had for a cousin's wedding 1 year ago. That'll do, said Bessie, falling back in her chair. I should be loath to have you looked down upon. Oh, I'll be fine enough, if that will save me from being looked down upon in Milton. I wish I could see you dressed up, said Bessie. I reckon you're not what folk would care pretty. We've not red and white enough for that. But don't you know, I'd dreamt of you long afore I ever seed you. Nonsense, Bessie. Aye, but I did. Your very face, looking with your clear, steadfast eyes out into darkness, with your hair blowing off from your brow, and going out like rays round yon forehead, which was just as smooth and straight as it is now. And you always came and give me strength, which I seemed to gather out of your deep, comforting eyes. And you were dressed in shiny raiment, just as you're going to be dressed. So you see, it was you. Nay, Bessie, said Margaret gently. It was but a dream. And why mightn't you not come in a dream in my affliction as well as others? Did not many a one into Bible? Aye, and see visions too. Why, even my father thinks a deal of dreams. I tell you again, I saw yous plainly, coming swiftly towards me, with your hair blowing back with the very swiftness of motion, just like the way it grows. A little standing off, and the white, shining dress you've getting to wear. Let me come and see you in it. I want to come see you, and touch you, as in very deed you were in my dream. My dear Bessie, it is quite a fancy of yours. Fancy or no fancy, you've come, as I knew you would, when I saw your movement in my dream, and when you're here about me, I reckon I feel easier in my mind, and comforted, just as a fire comforts one in 3 days. You said it were on to 21st. Please, God, I'll come and see you. Oh, Bessie, you may come and welcome, but don't talk so. It really makes me sorry. It does indeed. Then I'll keep it to myself, if I bite my tongue. Not but what it's true for all that. Margaret was silent. At last she said, "Let us talk about it sometimes, if you think it true. But not now. Tell me, has your father turned out?" "Aye," said Bessie, heavily, in a manner very different from that she had spoken but a minute or two before. "He and many others, all Amper's men, and many a one besides. That women are as bad as to men, in their savageness, this time. Food is aye, and they mun have food for their children, I reckon. S'pose Thornton sent them their dinner out, that same money, spent on potatoes and meal, would keep many a crying baby quiet, and hush up its mother's heart for a bit." "Don't speak so," said Margaret. "You'll make me feel wicked and guilty in going to his dinner." "No," said Bessie. "Some's pre-elected to sumptuous feasts and purple and fine linen. Maybe you're one of them. Others toil and moil all their lives long, and the very dogs are not pitiful in our days, as they were in the days of Lazarus. But if you ask me to cool your tongue with the tip of my finger, I'll come across the great gulf to you, just for the thought of what you've been to me here." "Bessie, you're very feverish. I can tell it in the touch of your hand, as well as in what you're saying. It won't be division enough, in that awful day, that some of us have been beggars here, and some of us have been rich. We shall not be judged by that poor accident, but by our faithful following of Christ." Margaret got up and found some water, and soaking her pocket handkerchief in it, she laid the cool wetness on Bessie's forehead and began to chafe the stone-cold feet. Bessie shut her eyes and allowed herself to be soothed. At last, she said, "You'd have been deaved out of your five wits, as well as me, if you'd had one body after another coming in to ask for father, and staying to tell me each one their tale. Some spoke a deadly hatred, and made my blood run cold with the terrible things they said of the master. But more, being women, kept plaining, with your tears running down their cheeks, and never wiped away nor heeded, or the price of meat, and how their children can sleep at night for the hunger. And do they think the strike will mend this?" asked Margaret. "They say so," replied Bessie. "They do say trade has been good for long, and the master has made no end of money. How much father doesn't know. But, in course, the union does, and, as it is natural, they wanted their share of the profits. Now that food is getting dear, and the union says they'll not be doing their duty if they don't make the masters give them their share. But masters has gotten to up hand somehow, and I'm feared they'll keep it now and evermore. It's like a great battle at Armageddon, the way they keep on, grinning and fighting at each other, till even while they fight they are picked off in the pit. Just then, Nicholas Higgins came in. He caught his daughter's last words. "Aye, and I'll fight on too, and I'll got it this time. I'll not take long for to make 'em give in, for they've getting a pretty lot of orders, all under contract, and they'll soon find out they'd better give a sour 5%, and lose the profit they'll gain, let alone the fine for not fulfilling the contract. Ahai, my masters, I'll know who'll win." Margaret fancied from his manner that he must have been drinking, not so much from what he said as from the excited way in which he spoke, and she was rather confirmed in this idea by the evident anxiety Bessie showed to hasten her departure. Bessie said to her, "The 21st, that's Thursday week. I may come and see you dressed up for the Thorntons, I reckon. What time is your dinner?" Before Margaret could answer, Higgins broke out, "Thorntons? Art thou going to dine at Thornton's? Ask him to give you a bumper to the success of his orders. Bite at 21st, I reckon. He'll be potted in his brains how to get 'em done in time. Tell him there's 700'll come marching into Marlborough Mills the morning after he gives the 5%, and we'll help him through his contract in no time. He'll have 'em all there, my master Amper. He's one of the old-fashioned sort. Ne'er meets a man about a oath or a curse. I should think he were going to die if he spoke me civil. But after all, his bark's worse than his bite, and you may tell him one of his turns out said so, if you like. Eh, but you'll have a lot of prize mill owners at Thornton's. I should like to get speech of them when they're a bit inclined to sit still after dinner, and couldna run for life of 'em. I'd tell 'em my mind. I'd speak up against the hard way they're driving us on." "Goodbye," said Margaret, hastily. "Goodbye, Bessie. I shall look to see you on the 21st, if you're well enough." The medicines and treatment which Dr. Donaldson had ordered for Mrs. Hale did her so much good at first that not only she herself, but Margaret began to hope he might have been mistaken and that she could recover permanently. As for Mr. Hale, although he had never had an idea of the serious nature of their apprehensions, he triumphed over their fears with an evident relief, which proved how much his glimpse into the nature of them had affected him. Only Dixon croaked forever into Margaret's ear. However, Margaret defied the raven and would hope. They needed this gleam of brightness indoors, for out of doors, even to their uninstructed eyes, there was a gloomy, brooding appearance of discontent. Mr. Hale had his own acquaintances among the working men, and was depressed with their earnestly told tales of suffering and long endurance. They would have scorned to speak of what they had to bear to anyone who might, from his position, have understood it without their words. But here was this man from a distant county who was perplexed by the workings of a system into the midst of which he was thrown, and each was eager to make him a judge and to bring witness of his own causes for irritation. Then Mr. Hale brought his budget of grievances and laid it before Mr. Thornton. For him, with his experience as a master, to arrange them and explain their origin, which he always did, on sound economical principles, showing that, as trade was conducted, there must always be a waxing and waning of commercial prosperity, and that in the waning a certain number of masters, as well as of men, must go down into ruin, and be no more seen among the ranks of the happy and prosperous. He spoke as if this consequence was so entirely logical that either employers nor employed had any right to complain of its becoming their fate. The employer to turn aside from the race he could no longer run, with a bitter sense of incompetency and failure, wounded in the struggle, trampled down by his fellows in their haste to get rich, slighted where he was once honoured, humbly asking for, instead of bestowing, employment with a lordly hand. Of course, speaking so of fate, as a master, might be his own in the fluctuations of commerce. He was not likely to have more sympathy with that of a workman who were passed by in the swift, merciless improvement or alteration, who would fain lie down and quietly die out of the world that needed them not, but felt as they could never rest in their graves for the clinging cries of the beloved and helpless they would leave behind, whose envied the power of the wild bird, that can feed her young with her very heart's blood. Margaret's whole soul rose up against him whilst he reasoned in this way, as if commerce were everything and humanity nothing. She could hardly thank him for the individual kindness which brought him that very evening to offer her, for the delicacy which made him understand that he must offer her privately every convenience for illness that his own wealth or his mother's foresight had caused them to accumulate in their household, and which, as he learnt from Dr. Donaldson, Mrs. Hale might possibly require. His presence, after the way he had spoken, his bringing before her the doom which she was vainly trying to persuade herself might yet be averted from her mother, all conspired to set Margaret's teeth on edge as she looked at him and listened to him. What business had he to be the only person, except Dr. Donaldson and Dixon, admitted to the awful secret, which she held shut up in the most dark and sacred recesses of her heart, not daring to look at it unless she invoked heavenly strength to bear the sight that, some day soon, she should cry aloud for her mother, and no answer would come out of the blank, dumb darkness. Yet he knew all. She saw it in his pitying eyes. She heard it in his grave and tremulous voice. How reconcile those eyes, that voice, with the hard, reasoning, dry, merciless way in which he laid down axioms of trade and serenely followed them out to their full consequences. The discord jarred upon her inexpressibly, the more because of the gathering woe of which she heard from Bessie. To be sure, Nicholas Higgins, the father, spoke differently. He had been appointed a committee man and said he knew secrets of which the exoteric knew nothing. He said this more expressly and particularly on the very day before Mrs. Thornton's dinner party. When Margaret, going in to speak to Bessie, found him arguing the point with Butchers, the neighbour of whom she had frequently heard mentioned, as by turn exciting Higgins' compassion, as an unskilful workman with a large family depending upon him for support, and at other times enraging his more energetic and sanguine neighbour by his want of what the latter called spirit. It was very evident that Higgins was in a passion when Margaret entered. Boscia stood, with both hands on the rather high mantelpiece, swaying himself a little on the support which his arms, thus placed, gave him, and looking wildly into the fire, with a kind of despair that irritated Higgins, even while it went to his heart. Bessie was rocking herself violently backwards and forwards, as was her wont, Margaret knew by this time, when she was agitated. Her sister Mary was trying on her bonnet, in great clumsy bows, as suited her great clumsy fingers, to go to her fuchsia cutting, blubbering out loud the while, and evidently longing to be away from a scene that distressed her. Margaret came in upon this scene. She stood for a moment at the door. Then, her fingers on her lips, she stole to a seat on the squab near Bessie. Nicholas saw her come in and greeted her with a gruff but not unfriendly nod. Mary hurried out of the house, catching gladly at the open door and crying aloud when she got away from her father's presence. It was only John Boscia that took no notice, whatever who came in and who went out. "It's no use, Higgins. Who cannot live long in this, and who's just sinking away, not for want of meat, Ursel, but because who cannot stand at sight of the little ones clemming? Aye, clemming. 5 shillings a week may do well enough for thee, with but 2 mouths to fill, and one of them a wench who can well earn her own meat. But it's clemming to us. And I tell thee plain, if who dies, as I'm afraid who will, afore we've getting the 5%, I'll fling the money back into master's face, and say, 'Be damned to ye, be damned to the old cruel world of ye, that couldn't leave me to best wife that ever bore children to a man.' And look thee, lad, I'll hate thee, and to all pack of the union, aye, and chase you through heaven with me hatred. I will, lad, I will, if you're leading me astray in this matter. Thou saidest, Nicholas, on Wednesday se'night, and it's now Tuesday in t' second week, that afore a fortnight we'd have the master coming a-begging to us to take us back to our work at our own wage, and time's nearly up. And there's our little Jack lying a bed, too weak to cry, but just every now and then, sobbing up his heart for want of food. Our little Jack, I tell thee, lad, who's never looked up sin' he were born, and who loves him as if he were her very life, as he is. For I reckon he'll have to cost me that precious price. Our little Jack, who wakened me each morn with putting his sweet little lips to my great rough face, a-seeking a smooth place to kiss, and he lies clemming. Here the deep sobs choked the poor man, and Nicholas looked up, with eyes brimful of tears, to Margaret, before he could gain courage to speak. Hold up, man. Thy little Jack shall ne'er clem. I ha' gotten brass, and we'll go buy the chap a sup o' milk and some good 4-pounder this very minute. What's mine's thine, sure enough. And thou'st I want. Only do not lose heart, man, continued he, as he fumbled in a teapot for what money he had. I lay your my heart and soul will win for this. It's but a bearing on one more week, and you just see to way to master's'll come round, praying on us to come back to our mills. And the union, that's to say, I will take care of you enough for the children and the missus. So do not turn faint heart, and go to tyrants a-seeking work. The man turned round at these words, turned round a face so white and gaunt and tear-furrowed and hopeless that its very calm forced Margaret to weep. You know well that a worser tyrant than e'er t' master was says, clem to death, and sees him a clem to death, ere you dare go again to union. You know it well, Nicholas, for you are a one of 'em, and you may be kind hearts, each separate, but once banded together, you've no more pity for a man than a wild, hunger-maddened wolf. Nicholas had his hand on the lock of the door. He stopped and turned round to Bosher, close following. So help me God, man alive, if I think not I'm doing best for thee and for all on us. If I'm going wrong when I think I'm going right, it's their sin who have left me where I am in my ignorance. I have thought till my brains ached. Belie me, John, I have. And I say again, there's no help for us but having faith in t' union. They'll win the day. See if they do not. Not one word had Margaret or Bessie spoken. They had hardly uttered the sign that the eyes of each called to each other to bring up from the depths of their heart. At last, Bessie said, I never thought to hear Father call on God again, but you heard him say, so help me God. Yes, said Margaret, let me bring you what money I can spare. Let me bring you a little food for that poor man's child. Don't let them know it comes from anyone but your father. It will be but little. Bessie lay back without taking any notice of what Margaret had said. She did not cry. She only quivered up her breath. My heart's drained dry of tears, she said. Bosher's been in these days past, a-telling me of his fears and his troubles. He's but a weak kind of chap, I know, but he's a man for that, and though I've been angry, many a time afore now, with him and his wife, as knew no more nor him how to manage. Yet you see, all folks isn't wise, yet God lets them live. Aye, and gives them someone to love, and be loved by, just as good as Solomon. And if sorrow comes to them they love, it hurts them as sore as ever it did Solomon. I can't make it out. Perhaps it's as well such as one as Boucher has to union to see after him. But I'd just like for to see to men as make to union, and put them one by one face to face with Boucher. I reckon if they heard him, they'd tell him, if I cotched them one by one, he might go back and get what he could for his work, even if it weren't so much as they'd ordered. Margaret sat utterly silent. How was she ever to go away into comfort and forget that man's voice, with the tone of unutterable agony, telling more by far than his words of what he had to suffer? She took out her purse. She had not much in it of what she could call her own, but what she had, she put into Bessie's hands without speaking. Thank you. There's many of them that gets no more, and is not so bad off. Leastways does not show it as he does. But father won't let him want, now he knows. You see, Boucher's been pulled down with his children, and her being so cranky, and they could pawn has gone this last 12 months. You're not to think we had letting them clem, for all we're a bit pressed ourselves. If neighbours doesn't see after neighbours, I dunno who will. Bessie seemed almost afraid lest Margaret should think they had not the will, and, to a certain degree, the power of helping one whom she evidently regarded as having a claim upon them. Besides, she went on, father is sure and positive that masters must give in within these next few days, that they canna hold on much longer. But I thank you all the same. I thank you for myself, as much as for Boucher, for it just makes my heart warm to you more and more. Bessie seemed much quieter today, but fearfully languid and exhausted. As she finished speaking, she looked so faint and weary that Margaret became alarmed. It's nowt, said Bessie. It's not death yet. I had a fearful night with dreams, or somewhat like dreams, for I were wide awake. And I'm all in a swounding day's day today. Only yon poor chap made me alive again. No, it's not death yet. But death is not far off. Aye, cover me up, and I'll maybe sleep, if t' cough will let me. Good night, or good afternoon, mayhappen I should say. But t' light is dim and misty today.